Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. President Trump's push to end birthright citizenship is headed to the Supreme Court.
Rooting out extremism in other agencies across the city is a priority.
An update on the city's efforts to remove extremist groups from the Chicago Police Department.
For the first time in the history of our species, we may actually be seeing signs of life elsewhere.
And researchers in England say they may have found evidence of life on a distant planet. And now to some of today's top stories. Details are being released about Pope Francis's funeral. The pontiff, who died Monday of a stroke and heart failure, will lie in state for 3 days, beginning Wednesday in St. Peter's Basilica for the public to pay their respects. The funeral will be on Saturday in St. Peter's Square. The conclave to select the next pope is expected to begin between May 5th and 10th. Outgoing Chicago Public Schools leader Pedro Martinez may have his next job all lined up. He'll be the new commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. Board members voted in his favor 9-0 with 2 abstentions. Martinez was chosen from a pool of 3 finalists. The state's current Secretary of Education, who has final approval, says Martinez has the, quote, bold, proven leadership the agency needs at this moment. He was set to remain on at CPS until June, as detailed by his contract, after the outgoing Board of Education fired him without cause back in December. No word yet on when Martinez's last day is expected to be. Men sentenced to probation through the Cook County criminal legal system will have a different place to land with the opening of the Lawndale Christian Legal Center's new Deer Center on the west side.
We hope that Cook County judges will see the value of placing a young person on probation here at the Deer Center instead of sending that person to prison. The goal is to keep them in our community with supports so that we can break that arrest jail cycle.
The center is named for former Cook County Commissioner Dennis Deer, who has served as the group's vice president when it broke ground in 2022. He died last year at the age of 51. The $22.5 million center will provide studio apartments to 20 18 to 25-year-old clients, along with workforce development skills, mental health treatment, and restorative justice healing circles. LCLC also connects clients with services for employment, housing, education, and other social needs. The first client is expected to arrive this month. Up next, the U.S. Supreme Court is set to hear arguments over the Trump administration's push to end birthright citizenship. And later in the program, how the Chicago Police Department is weeding out extremist cops.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The U.S. Supreme Court is agreeing to hear arguments next month over President Donald Trump's efforts to end birthright citizenship. Immigrant rights advocates point to the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to anyone born in the United States, even if their parents came here illegally. Meanwhile, the Trump administration argues children of non-citizens are not, quote, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and therefore not entitled to citizenship. Joining us are Elena Olea, deputy director of the nonprofit Alianza Americas, that's a Chicago-based network of American immigrant groups, and on Zoom, Richard Porter, former Illinois Republican National Committeeman. And we should also mention that both of you are attorneys, so that's good because we have to talk about some legal stuff. Elena Olea, let's start with you, please. Tell us what the Trump administration is trying to change about this long-standing law.
The Trump administration is trying to consider and present a new reinterpretation of the amendment of the Constitution that defines who is a citizen and who is not a citizen. And it's trying to exclude everyone whose parents are not here on a permanent basis.
Richard, this is something that Donald Trump campaigned on day one in office for this term. He signed that executive order to end birthright citizenship. Your thoughts on whether this longstanding law needs to be evaluated?
Well, so it's not a longstanding law. I mean, I think you're mischaracterizing that. But first, I just want to say to Elena, welcome to the United States. I understand you came to the United States on a Fulbright scholarship, and you're here on a work visa. And the United States is richer for having immigrants of talent and skill and ethics joining our citizenry. So thank you for coming to the United States. So if you look at the 14th Amendment, of course, the 14th Amendment, the Section 1 of the 14th Amendment was passed to clarify that slaves, former slaves, were citizens, and that was the original purpose of this section. But what it says is all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. And the question is, what's the subject to the jurisdiction thereof mean? And in a case in the Supreme Court in 1898, the Supreme Court heard a case involving a legal immigrant, somebody that was here on a permanent legal basis. They had children, one of whom was a young man who traveled to China when he was 21 and then came back, and he was told he wasn't a U.S. citizen. And this case was brought before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that the child of a legal resident of the United States was, pursuant to this clause, a citizen of the United States. The Supreme Court has never reached the question of whether a child of a guest, someone that just was a visitor to the United States, or is an illegal immigrant to the United States, whether the subject to the jurisdiction thereof extends to cover the child of either an illegal immigrant or somebody that's merely a tourist. So
Richard,
it's an open question asked to the Supreme Court.
But do you believe, are you under the impression that some people come here from other countries to just to give birth to their children, simply so that their children will have that citizenship?
Yeah, the Center for Immigration Studies estimates that about 35,000 people a year come in on mere visitors' visas to have children and then go back to their country of origin, plus hundreds of thousands of more people who are illegal immigrants come in pregnant or get pregnant shortly after they're here. So there is a relatively large pool of people for whom this is now an active question. And I think, unfortunately, that because the system has been abused, the U.S. has been relatively flexible about this over the course of many years. As a matter of practice, it hasn't scrutinized these issues too carefully. But because of the wave of immigration was so strong and the extent of illegal immigration has gotten to be so great, and because now the costs associated with this are also very large, there's real scrutiny being placed on the meaning of subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
I want to come back to that if we can, just because there's a lot to get to, specifically with what the Supreme Court is going to be taking up. But, Elena, I wanted to get your thoughts on some of what we're hearing from your co-panelist, Richard Porter, with regards to people coming to the country just for the purposes of having children.
Well, I wonder what is the basis for that extremely high number. I think that birth tourism is really an exception rather than a massive practice. It is true that many people come to the United States to study, particularly graduate students, and then may have come with their spouses, or they may have a relationship here and become parents. Those children would also be excluded under the interpretation of the executive order. There are also people working here temporarily and would be excluded.
Richard, go ahead.
If you're the child of a legal immigrant, I think that the existing Supreme Court precedent covers that situation. I think the focus of the executive order is children of people who are here merely visiting or that are illegal immigrants, that don't have a legal status within the United States.
Now, the
Supreme Court, when it looked at this question in 1898, focused on the question of allegiance when it looked at the subject to the jurisdiction thereof, that if the United States owes an allegiance to the child or the child and the child owes an allegiance back to the United States, that then is what the meaning of subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So the question is, does an illegal immigrant owe allegiance to the United States?
Well, and Richard, so it is a little bit complicated what it is the Supreme Court is actually considering, right? Because in this instance, they are not necessarily deciding the merits of the birthright citizenship law. It's actually about the enforcement of this executive order because of the states that have sued to stop it and what appeals court judges have ruled. So explain, if you would, the differences and what line the judges are actually walking. What are they actually deciding?
Well, so I think one of the first questions the court's going to have to decide is whether there's a case or controversy, whether they have jurisdiction over the matter, which is to say there has to be an actual live case in which someone who is a child of someone who is illegal, an illegal immigrant, or was, a visitor, brings the question before the court. The court doesn't give advisory opinions, so I'm not really sure how the court is necessarily going to reach the ultimate question. One point I want to point out, though, in the 14th Amendment, Section 5 says that Congress has the authority to enforce the other provisions of Article 14 by legislation. And so it says that Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article, which includes Section 1 and this question of birthright citizenship.
Well, and in,
so
in
I
this
think
instance,
there's going to be a question of interpretation, too, of does the president have power under the inherent executive authority to also create interpretations of that section.
Right, because in this instance, the Congress has not created a law other than obviously what the Constitution currently says. Elena, what are your thoughts on this and what the justices are, what arguments you're expecting to hear before the Supreme Court?
Well, the discussion at this moment is really going to be the scope of this suspension of the executive order. And this is something that the Trump administration has been complaining about because there are a number of judicial orders that have interrupted many of its actions and policies. Of course, this happens in every administration, and now it has been made an issue. But we're really not going to discuss the merits of this case. And I think that's really concerning because many children of parents born abroad have felt that this decision is telling them you are not really an American when they grew up feeling American because the understanding is if you're born in the United States, you are a U.S. citizen. And that really damages the fabric of society, and that should be a concern for us all.
What if the Supreme Court should side with the Trump administration on this particular issue, which is that his executive order can be enforced in some states, but not others? What if that is the case?
We're going to see then a flood of cases in the courts because, of course, parents have the expectation that the children are U.S. citizens, and there is an important support from the legal community because this is an element that is core to our understanding of what being an American person is.
Were you surprised that the Supreme Court decided to take this up?
It is surprising, but there's been a lot of pressure from the administration, so ultimately it had to give in, and I think it decided that this was what was worth the discussion.
Richard, I hear you trying to weigh in.
Well, what I was going to say is I do think that the laws on immigration need to be uniform. Article 1 of the Constitution provides that Congress has the authority to pass statutes for the uniform application of naturalization laws. So I think whatever interpretation will cover all of the United States. And the president does have power that's been delegated to him by Congress in the existing immigration laws. So I think it'll be a question of the extent of the delegation of authority to the president and his exercise of that power that he has inherently under Article 2, but also under the immigration statutes that exist. And one thing, I just want to point a couple things out.
We're going to have that discussion next time we have you on. I apologize because we are actually out of time. But hearings are in May. I am sure this is a conversation we will come back to. Richard Porter and Elena Olea, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, the city's status on removing extremist groups from the Chicago Police Department. Brandon Johnson formed a task force in February to examine how to rid the Chicago Police Department of officers with ties to extremist groups. 2 months later, the effort has yet to show any sign of public progress. In his first public remarks about the task force, Johnson pledged to root out extremism.
I'm committed to ensuring that every single city employee represents the values of working people, and whether they are a police officer or a teacher or anyone who works in street and sanitation, they have to uphold those principles.
And our Heather Sharone joins us now with more. Heather, the mayor agreed to form this task force 8 months ago, or 8 months after Inspector General Deborah Witzberg urged him to take a new approach in his push to terminate police officers who engage in extremist and anti-government activities or associate with groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. Where does this effort stand?
Well, we learned today that this task force has met twice and will meet for a third time, perhaps coincidentally, tomorrow. There are four additional meetings scheduled with the goal, Deputy Mayor Garian Gatewood told me, of having some sort of recommendation that can be released publicly by the end of the summer. However, both the mayor and the deputy mayor made it clear that this task force isn't just looking at CPD and extremists in CPD, but citywide in any department. I should be clear, there have been no allegations against city employees of any other department having ties to these sort of groups.
Any other department other than CPD,
correct,
of course. Has the task force made any progress?
So none that we can tell, because these are not meetings that are subject to the open meeting rules. We can't go to these meetings, and they have not sort of said anything about what they're looking at doing. That flies in the face of a recommendation from Inspector General Deborah Witzberg, who said that it is best to sort of update the public as much as possible to foster trust in whatever this group is going to recommend, because these are very difficult issues that, of course, raise First Amendment concerns. And there's a lot at stake for the mayor, because these are the people who are, of course, trusted to carry out the law in Chicago.
Alderman Matt Martin, the chair of the Ethics Committee, is working to pass an ordinance that would allow city officials to fire employees who actively participate in extremist organizations that advocate for the overthrow of the government. Where does that stand?
Well, perhaps also coincidentally, Alderman Martin introduced his ordinance just 2 days before the mayor agreed to form this task force. The ordinance hasn't yet made it to a hearing. Alderman Martin told me he's still workshopping it and gathering support. However, he says that he hasn't been read in on anything that the working group is doing. So it appears to be two separate paths moving through City Hall to sort of address this issue. Oh, and Inspector General Witzberg says she doesn't know what's going on in the task force either.
Nobody's updated her either. Okay. Heather Sharone, she'll be getting those updates for us as they're available. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. Scientists at the University of Cambridge using the James Webb Space Telescope say they have detected possible signs of life on a distant exoplanet. The tentative discovery is based on the detection of sulfur-based molecules, thankfully abbreviated to DMS, in the atmosphere of the planet. Here's Professor Nikku Madhusudan from the team explaining what they think they may have found.
DMS stands for dimethyl sulfide. This is a very important molecule because here on Earth, DMS is produced uniquely by life, microorganisms in the ocean like algae, phytoplankton. And theoretical studies had predicted for the last two decades that molecules like DMS would be very robust biomarkers on exoplanetary systems.
And joining us now to help us understand the significance of all of this is Michelle Nichols, an astronomer and director of public observing at the Adler Planetarium. Public observing sounds like a good gig. Thank you for joining us. Okay, so before we talk about the possible life, tell us what we know about the planet, K218b.
All right, so this is a planet that orbits a red dwarf star. So that means it's a star that's cooler, smaller than our sun, 124 light years away. So far, but not too far. And it orbits in what's called the star's habitable zone, meaning the planet is far enough away from the star that if there was water on the surface of the planet, that it would have a chance to be liquid. The temperature could be right for that.
It's a cute little star, right? But
yep.
The planet is huge.
Yeah, so the planet would be more like closer to Neptune-sized in terms of mass, so bigger than Earth, a little bit smaller than Neptune, so definitely we don't have an analog to it in our own solar system.
Okay, and that star, it's about half the size of our sun.
Yes, correct.
Okay. So as we've heard, Cambridge researchers, they think they've detected potential signs of life in the atmosphere there. What makes DMS so special as a biomarker?
Well, on Earth, it is a material that is produced uniquely by life. However, it's not the only way that you can get this material. So there's been a debate in the astrobiology community. Is this a unique sign of life? If we find it someplace else, does that mean there's life there? And the answer is, maybe, maybe not. There could be other ways to make this stuff, especially on a planet that is so different from our own. There could be some processes there that are completely different. So it's still a debate as to whether or not it's a unique biomarker.
Right. Just because it creates life on this planet does not mean that those biomarkers also create life, or that those, whatever they are, DMSs, that they also create life on that planet too.
Yeah, it would be a material that's created by life. So it would be a gas that's given off potentially by life, at least
like
here.
Like methane.
Yes, exactly, correct.
Okay. How was this detection made? How'd they find it?
So it's made by the James Webb Space Telescope. So what happens is when the planet passes between the star and Earth, the light from the star will pass through the atmosphere of the planet, little tiny atmosphere, because it's really far away. And the substances in the atmosphere will imprint themselves essentially on the light that we get. So we have to tease out this information of what's the light from the star, what's the light that's passing through the atmosphere of the planet itself. But from that, you can start to determine what this air is actually made of, which in itself is a pretty cool thing to be able to do. And so they found a faint detection of a couple of gases that might maybe be a biomarker, possibly.
How confident do you think we can be in these findings? And if they're confirmed, I don't know how that would be, how significant might that be?
So how confident are we? Not yet scientifically confident. If you were to go to a casino, it would be 99.7% sure that this isn't just a fluke. It isn't just a random occurrence of information. That's good enough for casino, not good enough for science. We need to be 99.99999% sure, and we're not there yet. So there's still a lot of scientists going, hey, we still need more data. But even if they do say, yep, it's actually there, if they find enough information to say, yeah, it's there, it still doesn't satisfy the question of how did it get there. And there could be some very non-life processes that could possibly produce this stuff on a world that is very different from our own.
What level of proof would you need to see? Yes, like what would make evidence of life, basically?
You would need multiple lines of evidence. It wouldn't just be finding this material. It'd be finding other materials, trying to figure out what the surface of this planet is even like. Right now, there are two main camps. It could be an ocean world with a hydrogen atmosphere. Okay, not too bad. It could be a liquid magma-covered world. Definitely not able to host life. So we need to figure out what the surface of this planet is even like in the first place. And then other pile on more information, and when you start to get multiple lines of evidence that this place could be hospitable to life, then you might be getting closer.
I mean, it seems like it would take a while to gather that evidence, and also maybe some advances in technology.
Correct. Yeah, there may be technology needed that we don't have yet. So a lot more information might be needed in the future. So it's going to take a while before people are satisfied with this.
What do you think is the most likely way to do that, aside from the 124-year trip to get there?
Right. Exactly. At the speed of light, which you can't do. I'd say try to look for it in our own solar system. We're more likely to find it if it's here. We're more likely to find it on a place that's a lot easier to get to in terms of time. Maybe Mars, maybe Jupiter's moon Europa, maybe Saturn's moon Enceladus. But all these worlds could have aspects to them that might help us know a little bit more easily, come at those multiple lines of evidence, get that direct evidence that maybe we could see this at some point in the future. Finding it here in our own solar system be a lot harder finding it so far away.
Why do you think this potential finding garnered so much excitement over the last week?
Everybody loves aliens.
The potential for aliens.
Got everybody's attention. So it shows the process of science. I mean, it shows that, yes, we come up with information, come up with some ideas, get more information. You might have to revise those ideas. You might have healthy debates about it. You might have disagreements about it. That's how science works. And so that's the fun part about it. And it's always fun to dream, to see, could there be life out there?
What, and what
we
might
don't
they
know.
Be like? Yes,
yeah,
they haven't
exactly.
built whole cities, and they've got their own way of communicating the way we do. What else? We've got about 30 seconds left. What else is happening at the Adler Planetarium this week?
Well, come on down. You can come and see our Other Worlds exhibit. It's all about planets in our own solar system and worlds in other solar systems. So come on down and learn about planets around other stars.
See? So if we don't have life out there, then you can just come to the Adler and learn a little bit more
anytime.
About what's happening there. All
yep.
right. Michelle Nichols, Adler Planetarium, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this Tuesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. The gunman in the Highland Park parade shooting is set to be sentenced weeks after a surprise guilty plea. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.